importantly, we don't just focus on the sustainability positioning, though, because we think quality is essential to having a sustainable company. And when we talk about quality, we're talking about the franchise of the company. So is the business making necessary goods and services that people need or that are helping us meet those environmental challenges? And also the trust in the business and the reputation of the business is tied into that. We talk about management quality. And then lastly, the quality of financials. Those things come together, and the sustainability positioning really tell us about what sort of companies we want to be invested in. And the stewardship aspect with management is really key to all of that.
Welcome to another episode of the ESG Factor podcast. Today I'm talking to Pablo Baruti, Senior Investment Specialist at Stewart Investors based in Sydney. Pablo, thanks for taking the time to come on the podcast today.
Thanks, Vincent. Good to be here.
So sustainability is a hot topic right now. What does it mean to you and your team when you're selecting companies to invest in?
It is a hot topic. And I think for us, we've launched our first sustainable development focused fund in 2005 when the topic wasn't quite so hot, and slightly before the kind of ESG moniker was established. And so going back to that time and also primarily investing in Asia Pacific at that time as well, we always took quite a broad view of sustainable development, and a chart that we use quite a lot in trying to describe how we think about it is that the Global Footprint Network has a chart where on the x-axis they put human development using the Human Development Index, and then on the y-axis they put global biocapacity per capita. And what you see in that chart as you play it forward is for each country, the higher the level of human development, the higher the environmental impact, to a point where we are living unsustainably, using more than a planet's worth of resources for the development that we have. And so we took the quite sort of simple and broad view that sustainable development for us is really about breaking that relationship, because we want to see high levels of human development, but we need to do it in a way that fits within the environmental capacity of the planet. So when you do that kind of broader approach, things become apparent, like the interconnections between different issues. We can't really solve the really big problems of our times, whether they're climate change or biodiversity loss or pollution issues, if we don't actually have a system which is equitable, that helps people come out of poverty, that gives access to financial products, for instance, or to food and beverage products, basic needs, soaps and other consumer goods. And so all of those things kind of blend together when we're thinking about what is a sustainable company. And we talk about, in that broad sense, the sustainability positioning of a company, and we talk about headwinds and tailwinds. And that's the basic idea, that with the products and services that this company sells, are they going to do well as we move into a more sustainable economy, or are they going to face headwinds, which will mean that they'll be challenged? And so companies that are helping people at the bottom of the pyramid to access those consumer products are going to have sustainability tailwinds. Companies that are focused on the zero carbon transition are going to have tailwinds, whereas other companies that are exploitative in nature through their business models, in terms of their people, say their labor force and supply chains, or who are perhaps connected to the old economy through fossil fuels, will face these headwinds and challenges. Importantly, we don't just focus on the sustainability positioning, though, because we think quality is essential to having a sustainable company. And when we talk about quality, we're talking about the franchise of the company. So is the business making necessary goods and services that people need or that are helping us meet those environmental challenges? And also the trust in the business and the reputation of the business is tied into that in terms of the quality of that franchise. We talk about management quality, and that's traditional things around the competence of the management team, of course, but also, are they good stewards of the business? Do they take a long-term view? Do they treat their stakeholders fairly? Have we got evidence of the management doing that in practice? How do they react when something goes wrong? Those types of things help paint a picture around the quality of management. And then lastly, the quality of financials, which in the type of world that we live in today, and as we move forward in the sustainable development transition that we have to undertake, we feel that companies that are more resilient with stronger balance sheets and net cash, who have more sustainable earnings, and can demonstrate that through an economic cycle, that aren't taking shortcuts on things like paying not enough tax, for instance, or trying to leverage their relationships with their suppliers and have long payable days are all kind of examples that we use to try and understand really how resilient is the financial quality, the franchise quality, and the management quality. And so those things come together, and the sustainability positioning really tell us about what sort of companies we want to be invested in. And the stewardship aspect with the management is really key to all of that.
Can I just bring you back to a point there, Pablo, on the sustainable economic development, which you mentioned? There's a little bit of a conundrum with sustainable economic development, because the more these countries develop, the more demands that are being placed on the resources that we have and the planet that we're using. And in the same idea, you've got companies that are looking to grow, and along with that growth, they're using up increased resources. So how do you find companies that are actually producing a return for investors, let's say, in a more sustainable manner, and that are doing so using, as you said, those resources more efficiently, and not just saying, okay, well, we have a sustainable brand, but it's the same model, consume, consume, consume?
It's a fantastic point, because the economic system that we have is very much a linear one, where we take, make, use, and then waste, whereas we really need to close the loop on that. And so we have to have waste equaling food. And so waste ought to be either thought of as a useful input into a natural system so that it's compostable, biodegradable, or it's a useful input into another industrial process. So we're capturing those streams of resources and bringing it in. Now, there are companies that are on the journey of trying to get there. And I'll give you an example of Philips, for instance, who make medical equipment. You'll find them in many hospitals, x-ray machines, MRI machines, all of those types of big kit. They want to generate 25% of their revenue, their goal, from circular economy revenues. And so they talk about how do they take those products and refurbish them, put them into different uses, upgrade them, and really take a more of a service model. And so how do you change the business model so that it's not just selling products and then at the end of its life, it's someone else's problem? And I think we need to see that across all businesses. And they're the kinds of ethos that we look for in the quality of management. There's not a company that's at the end of that journey yet, but we see many great examples of companies who have accepted that that's the way things need to go.
Okay. So what you're saying is the circular economy is a huge part of finding companies that are more sustainable.
It has to be, just in terms of the way that the whole economy operates. And I think sustainable returns and sustainable earnings, there's sort of assumptions built into that. So if we just think about returns, and in our industry, we talk a lot about risk-adjusted returns, and traditionally that's just based on interest rates or the risk-free rate. What is risk in the context of a 2, 3, 4 degree world? What is risk in a biodiversity crisis where we're losing species at levels not seen for millions of years? And so these are different types of questions in terms of what growth and sustainability of earnings look like in a different type of economy. And so are you growing because you are providing the solutions and the essential components of a new and different and more sustainable economy, or are you just growing for the sake of it because that's the only way that we've ever known? And so that they're the types of sort of deeper questions that we try to ask ourselves. And that's where we talk about that idea of sustainability tailwinds. And so we are looking for companies that are growing, but we're looking for companies that are growing because the products and services that they're providing are essential to that transition to a more sustainable way of doing things.
And as an active manager, your position is to take a more concentrated approach to your portfolios. Is it difficult to find these types of companies?
So we have a great luxury in being an active manager. And so there's 60,000 odd companies, say, in the universes that we invest in, and we only need to find 40 or 60 high quality companies that are well positioned for sustainable development to invest in. And so on one level, that's a great luxury that we have, because we don't need to make compromises on quality or sustainability positioning, and recognizing that there's no company that's perfect or finished that journey yet. But we can hold a very high standard there. I think in any circumstance, it is difficult in the markets that we operate in. There's a lot of short-termism in markets. There's a lot of pressure on companies, or has been historically, to gear up. And so when we're looking for those conservative management teams that can actually take a longer-term view, not be pressured into driving the quarterly earnings result, but really investing for the future and for the long-term, who are, you know, preserve their balance sheets because they recognize that in more difficult times they'll need to be able to draw on that to maintain themselves and to then succeed on the other side of it. But those characteristics are more challenging to find at times. But I think we've managed okay, and we're forever trying to get better. We have this kind of saying that we have internally around the embarrassment credo, where we want to be embarrassed about the things that we were doing 5 years ago when we look at them today, and hopefully in 5 years' time we'll be embarrassed about the things that we're doing today. And so it's forever a process of trying to continuously find better quality companies and go along with the companies that we're invested in today on a journey of their improving quality, because we do like to have a 10-year view when we value a company, and they're the sort of time horizons that we want to be invested in companies for.
And so is it easier to define your universe by the sustainability factors primarily, and then assess them based on valuation when you're selecting portfolios? Or do you look through the lens of risk and return firstly, and then look at the sustainability of the business?
It's actually a much more organic process than that, rather than, so it's not really around taking 60,000 companies and then trying to filter it down to an acceptable list. Rather, it's more bottom up. And so when we're looking at that, a company that we're, and because we've been investing in this way for quite a long time, we're looking at who are the companies that are in the same sector as a company that we already really like and are comfortable with, who are high quality, who are their suppliers that are high quality, what are certain industries that we think are going to be particularly well positioned from a sustainable development perspective, and who are the better players in that sector. And each of the analysts in the team, and we're a fairly small team, so there's 14 in the investment team, have the freedom to really explore a lot of their own ideas in relation to how they find those high quality companies that are well positioned for sustainable development. And then once they've found a candidate for inclusion in portfolio, we'll typically write a company report, which is very detailed, looks at those quality factors that I mentioned, along with the sustainable positioning. And there's a lot of discussion amongst the team. And sometimes it can take years before we actually make an investment in that company, because we might not just be able to get over the line in terms of a quality aspect, or we're not quite sure on the management team and whether they're really in it for the long term. And we'll continue to monitor those companies. And so we have this kind of quality list of 300 odd companies that we're continuously looking at and trying to understand and build confidence in before including them in the portfolio. Other times we can, because of references from management teams that we already trust and we think are really high quality, or we see that people move across to different businesses, or when we analyze them, the history is really apparent that they do have that long-term view. They might have a cornerstone family shareholder or a foundation as a shareholder that has been able to implement a very long-term view in the way that the company operates, and a view that has a greater social purpose as well in the way that the company operates, we can get comfortable sometimes more quickly. And so it really varies by the company, but the process is very much organic, bottom up, and really trying to find each analyst really acting a bit like a ferret, trying to find those great quality companies, rather than really taking a really kind of more top-down systematic screening and filtering approach to our investment universe.
And so the fact that you have a relatively concentrated portfolio, you are a long-term investor, as you said, 10-year time horizon, you're a steward of capital effectively. Does that give you the opportunity to exert some influence on the company in terms of making sure that they prioritize sustainability?
It's a key part of both how we come to understand companies, our engagement with companies, but also in terms of how we can try and influence them as a long-term partner. And so there's a lot of discussion in the industry around engagement, how it's to be done. You see the very many high profile cases are adversarial in nature, and proxy votes and shareholder activism and those types of things. We like to say that we're an active shareholder, not an activist shareholder, and it comes down to the fact that it's our investment philosophy and process that we like the companies that we're investing in. We're trying to build a long-term relationship with these companies. They're generally on the path already, because we wouldn't be investing in them if they weren't. And however, we recognize that there's no such thing as a perfect company, and we're trying to express a view and trying to encourage them to get better in certain areas where we think that there's going to be risks and issues for them. The other aspect of it is that we also don't assume that every single company is going to respond in exactly the same way. And so it tells us a lot about the quality of the management team when we're engaging with companies, and that sort of feeds into that quality assessment as well. So if we find that a company is not responding, or they're perhaps trying to duck an issue and minimize an issue rather than actually taking responsibility for it, they're all parts of the jigsaw that really helps us understand the quality of the company. And eventually, and sometimes it can take several years, sometimes it might just take a few months, we might wind up selling out of the company if we just feel that that our assessment of quality has suffered so much because the engagement hasn't gone in the way that we would have hoped.
So you mentioned that Stuart Investors have been doing this since 2005, incorporating sustainability. It's not just a hot topic for your organization. Obviously, the Sustainable Development Goals are set in 2015. We're 7 years on now. We're failing dramatically on those goals. Yes, sustainable investing continues to gather momentum. Climate finance, sustainable finance, green finance, you name it. There's many different terms. But do you envisage a time where this change in finance is actually going to translate into the sustainable development goals that everyone likes to talk about?
I certainly hope so. And we should all hope so, because whether we like to think so or not, the finance sector and private capital is going to have to play a really important role in delivering those sustainable development objectives. And there are some aspects of the way that capitalism or markets and the investment industry operate today that are not related to those sustainability issues, but that hold us back from being able to deal with them. So I mentioned things like short-termism. I mentioned things like taking a very narrow approach to what a sustainable return is and what risk is in the nature of those businesses, but also the responsibility that those businesses have to their employees, to their suppliers, to be good environmental stewards. And so I think at the moment, we're still, when we talk generally across the industry about sustainable investment, ESG investing, responsible investing, it is still taking that old view of extracting a bit more return from our investments, and that's the only reason that we do it, and we shouldn't care about any other reasons. But I think if you think about it over the long run and you think about the nature of the issues that we face, that view is only going to get us so far. We really need to accept as an industry a responsibility, and as you mentioned, like, we're stewards of capital. It's very rarely is it our own money that we're dealing with, and our clients and people at large who have retirement savings, for instance, expect us to be thinking about these issues, expect us to act ethically in the way that we deal with their money. And so to get back to your question, do I see a time that we get there? I certainly hope so. I feel like there are some really good signs. If you go back 10 years, the idea of investors having a purpose to try and deliver SDGs, investors trying to have impact as a distinct and measurable part of what they do, was not really part of the conversation at all at the large mainstream investor level, whereas today that is very much part of the conversation. We do, however, still have these issues of greenwashing and other aspects where it is very difficult for people to understand what is really going on and the actual quality of the investments that are being made. And so we face some real challenges, but I feel like there are some positive signs that the culture and the attitude of the investment community is starting to shift.
And when it comes to greenwashing, I mean, it's difficult as an investment manager, because I know chatting to different investment managers saying, well, we do sustainable investing the right way. Over there, they're actually just greenwashing. So there's a lot, I hear a lot of that still, but it's very difficult for advisors, trustees, and even investors, the ordinary investor, to understand, well, what's actually sustainable investing? Where is my money going? What's the impact? And what's just kind of branded with a kind of sustainability brand. What key things do you think that the average investor or a capital allocator should be looking at to identify some of the blatant greenwashing that might be out there?
We often say that there's many ways up the mountain. And so I don't know, we wouldn't say that our approach to sustainable investing is the only approach that's going to work. There are going to be multiple ways depending on different needs and exposures that different investors have. For us, because we're bottom up, so for instance, that example of engagement that we just talked about, it's going to be different for us because we've got that relatively concentrated portfolio. We're trying to build 10-year relationships. So the way that we engage with companies is necessarily going to be different to an investor that holds 1,000 or 3,000 companies in their portfolio and has to look at the world in a very different way. However, if we want to simplify it, and there's so many complex new standards emerging, whether it's the EU taxonomy and different types of revenue models for understanding alignment with the SDGs, or the Task Force for Nature Finance Disclosure, the TCFD on climate. I mean, there's a plethora of different ways that you can try and demonstrate sustainability. But I like to think about it in terms of three simple questions. And that is it meaningful for the company? And that can be things like revenue and R&D and CapEx. But it can also come down to culture. It can come down to the way that they deal with issues. It can come down to the types of markets that they operate in. So a bank operating in a country like India is going to have a different type of impact to a bank operating in the United States. And that's a function of where they are as much as what they do. And so is it meaningful for the company? And then the second question is it going to make a meaningful difference to the issue? And we can use lots of different solution frameworks. So we like to use Project Drawdown on climate, which we could talk a little bit more about in a sec, but that's identified 80 different climate change solutions, and that can help us understand how the companies we're investing in are contributing and whether they're going to be able to make a meaningful impact to resolving some of the great challenges that we face. And the last one, and perhaps the most important one of all, is it balanced? And so is the investor or is the company just giving a great news story of all the wonderful things they're doing and not actually acknowledging the challenges that they face and how difficult it is, because none of this stuff is easy, and none of us are at the end of the path. And so I think companies and investors who are acknowledging that embarrassment credo, if you like, that we're constantly trying to get better, that things we were doing 5 years ago weren't good enough, the things that we're doing today won't have been good enough in 5 years' time. I think that type of transparency and honesty about the situation that we're in is really critical, because at the moment, in terms of that whole greenwashing thing, I think one of the big things that comes out of it is this idea that the whole story is rosy if we invest in a certain way. And so I'll give you an example. One is we need lots more renewable energy, and solar in particular, to transform the energy system and to make it reliant on renewables as opposed to fossil-based energy sources. But we have a lot of modern slavery risks, particularly associated in China and the Uyghur people. And so Chinese solar manufacturers actually dominate the market globally, and a lot of the polysilicon still winds up in other manufacturers. And so how do investors actually deal with that issue rather than just saying, oh, we're invested in solar and so therefore we're done and that's a great story? I think we really need to try and challenge ourselves and each other to recognize that this is going to be an ongoing area of improvement that we all have to undertake. And if we're not being honest about that, then it's probably one good sign of some greenwash going on.
Yeah, well, I think you make some important points there, because first of all, there's a complexity to any company or any organization or any investment fund. And recognizing that is important, because at times you see some of the coverage of ESG investing or sustainable investing, whatever term is preferred to be used, and it kind of just throws all different approaches under one label. And you know yourself, even with equity investing, there's many, many different approaches. And so I think it's important to recognize the nuances between those different approaches, like you said at the start, and your approach is just one of them. And so what we need is a more informed audience that they can kind of differentiate between those different approaches. And then we need more informed advisors to be able to understand the different preferences of those underlying clients and align those preferences with the solutions. And I think that's probably where I see the next step that we have to make in terms of sustainable investing being meaningful, so that the capital actually flows into the right funds. And obviously, we, a part of that, we need everybody to be more informed. So that's very important. I think one other point I want to ask you about is the use of ESG, the ESG framework. Obviously, it's been around a long time since 2005. It's come to prominence more in recent years. It's got very kind of polarizing views. It's a bit like politics in the United States. It's really extreme left or extreme right. And sometimes I feel like it's just the bigger picture has been missed, that it's just a framework. And applying it is what gives it meaning. So I'm just interested to understand how you and your team, if you use it within your own investment process.
So I mean, I think if you get underneath the surface and think about the issues embedded within ESG, they're very important issues, different levels of importance for different types of companies depending on what they do, where they are, those types of questions. But I think unfortunately a lot of the discussion, and we haven't, like what you said before, Vincent, about helping people be better informed about the way that investors invest, we're not helping them very much in terms of the way that products are being put forward and ESG frameworks are being used. And so there's been controversy recently about Tesla falling out of one of the ESG indices, but then you've got tobacco companies that have been in the Dow Jones Sustainability Index for decades. And I don't know that it's particularly clear to the investors investing in those products, what they're actually trying to achieve. And they may well be very much surprised and disappointed to find those types of things happening. Now, so I think that is a key part of it. Now, the other bit is that we, as an industry, do like to kind of do things by formula. We like to systematize things. There is that approach to doing things. We're very qualitative in a lot of the assessment we do of companies. We try to understand the people. We ultimately want to ask the question, can we trust these people with our clients' capital? Will they look after it? Will they use it in the right way? That's the underpinning question to all of our investing. But a lot of what we see in terms of the more systematized approach is what you might, it's almost like coloring by numbers. It's sustainability by numbers. And so we were looking at a research provider, a data provider the other day who does revenue allocations for the sustainable development goals. And in some areas we agree, but then they have these weird things that happen. Like, for instance, if you look at the Access to Medicines Index, the bottom five companies in the Access to Medicines Index have the same revenue allocation according to this provider as the top five in terms of satisfying SDG 3, good health and well-being. Now, clearly that's not right if you're actually thinking about improving access and affordability of healthcare. And so I think there's always these dangers that lurk in taking this overly systematized, really trying to draw hard boundaries around issues. Now, again, that's a luxury we have as a bottom-up investor with a very strong focus on the qualitative aspects that we can do it that way. But it is something that people need to be aware of, that there are all of these kind of unintended consequences that come out of it. I think the other aspect is in terms of the frameworks is that they can be very useful, but in terms of using it as a way to understand the quality and the positioning of the companies going forward, as opposed to being the ultimate answer and arbiter of what is and isn't sustainable, it's really part of the overall story. And so with and I mentioned Project Drawdown before, in addition to using external frameworks like that, we also commission a lot of our own research. As an investment team, we're all generalists. We don't claim to be, whether it's in traditional investment context, sector or country specialists, but we're also, we have good diversity of qualifications in terms of sustainability across the team, but we don't claim to be particular specialists on something like renewable energy, for instance. So these frameworks help us, but then also we commission research where we're really trying to dig deeper into an issue. And so one of the things that come out of the Project Drawdown work is the role of the food system and how essential that will be to reducing emissions, but also the role of smallholder farmers in that, because they play a critical role in the food system. And so we commissioned research from a specialist development agency researcher to understand that issue better. And what does that mean for companies? Because if you're a Unilever or a Nestle, and you know that 40% of the world's palm oil comes from smallholder farmers, that 70% of the world's coffee, cacao, sugar, that they're a critical part of your supply chain, but because they're so dispersed, they're very difficult to deal with. And so what are these companies doing to try and better understand these supply chains to be able to manage them more effectively? And that not only helps them with dealing with climate challenges, say around deforestation, but also dealing with the human rights and human development impacts, because smallholder farmers are also very low income people. There's limited access to education for children. So you see a lot of children working on smallholder farms, whereas if they had better access to education, they might have other opportunities. The way that pricing transparency works in a lot of those markets makes it really unfair in terms of the pricing that they're able to achieve. And so by flipping the narrative and actually looking at it from a different angle, it gives us a much better idea of what consumer goods companies and the challenges that they're facing. And so we invest in a company called Marico, for instance. They're in India. They're the largest coconut buyer in India. They do a lot of coconut oil, both for cooking and for hair products and other healthy food products. So from a sustainability positioning and tailwinds, we think they've got very strong tailwinds. But clearly, that supply chain aspect is an area that is going to be very important for them, because coconuts are absolutely critical to their business. And if copper prices go up or down, that makes a big impact on their earnings. And Marico have been working for years with smallholder farmers to help them improve their yields in a sustainable way, to provide systems around them, try and deal with them directly as much as possible rather than through the aggregation methods. And so you see in their approach to dealing with those farmers, not only is it helping to improve those sustainable development challenges, but it makes them a better and more sustainable business over the long run, because they're going to have more secure, more understandable supply over the long run. And so it really plays into both areas. One other example on the smallholder front is HDFC. They're a finance company in India. Half of their branches are in rural areas. They provide a lot of financial products that are really important to ensure that there's some financial security around smallholder farmers. And we've seen heat waves in India. We've seen flooding in India just in the course of the last few months. And so products like insurance, crop insurance, post and pre-harvest loans to help them be able to achieve their harvest and then to be able to sell it in an efficient way and to prepare for the next one, build resilience in their farms. All of these types of financial products are going to be essential for a more sustainable agricultural supply chain. Now, HDFC is not an agricultural company, but are they having a positive impact because of the way that they do their business in these areas? Absolutely they are. And I think when you take the color by numbers approach to sustainability, you'd never recognize the kind of impact that HDFC is having in rural India. And that's where I think really taking that stepping back and trying to take that broader approach and then looking at issues in different ways can really help you understand companies in ways that you perhaps wouldn't do ordinarily.
Yeah, and I suppose that's where the active management, that's where the case for active management comes in, to be able to look at these companies in a more holistic way. I think your mention of Tesla obviously has a big following, a cult following, some might say, but the reaction to Tesla not being included in the ESG index from Standard & Poor's got a lot of people talking, and I suppose the response from the CEO on Twitter maybe showed why, from a governance perspective and a management perspective, some of their criteria mightn't be rated that highly, let's just say. But if you look at the underlying management of a company and how sustainable it is through the lens of ESG, do investors need to better understand the fact that, okay, that is one thing, understanding how the company is operating. But then, as you said, the underlying impact that the company is having. So Tesla is obviously one example which gets people divided. But you look at, there was a beer company in Europe. I won't mention specific names, but they were saying they were the first climate neutral beer company. And then obviously some stuff came out about how they were treating employees. You have, you fast food companies that maybe run well, they may be treating employees well, but they're contributing to obesity. The same with the likes of the soft drink companies. You've got a company you mentioned, Nestle, they've said it themselves, their products are unhealthy. The vast majority of their products are unhealthy, and they're trying to figure out, right, how do we future-proof our business? Well, one of the things we have to do is we have to shift our product line to healthier products. So in terms of when you look at companies, do you place greater weight on the underlying impact that that company is having on society and the communities? Or do you think where ESG is maybe falling short, or maybe people just aren't aware of the limits of ESG, that it's more on the how a company is managed, risk return, that type of stuff? That's the traditional stuff that they're still anchoring to. That's part of the confusion, really, isn't it?
It is. I mean, for us, it's really both. And I don't know that you can, in some ways, they're really difficult to separate because they feed into each other. There's lots of feedback loops that exist between a company's impact and its ESG management. Like, you expect mining companies, because they have a high impact, to have really good policies and processes. And I thought your interview with Amanda about Vale was excellent, because the example that she gave, where Vale had no one expected anything to go terribly wrong there, because there's their ESG processes around safety, and everyone had to wear hard hats and all of those types of things, check in three times before you can do anything, seem to be squeaky clean. But then the really big risk, the catastrophic risk that can come from tailings dams, was almost entirely missed. And so I think that really shows how you need to look at both ends, because you clearly don't want workers to be unsafe. So those safety practices and ESG practices are important, but you can't ignore those big picture issues. And whether it's foods that cause obesity, sugary foods and sugary drinks, and those types of impacts, or whether it's the supply chain impacts that we mentioned before, they're all critical to understand. I think with the quality aspects, I say, going back to Tesla, we've not invested in Tesla, not because we don't think that electric vehicles are a really important part of the climate solutions story, but because we've really struggled with the governance, and we've struggled with the financial quality and trying to understand how the pathway to profitability, and how are they going to be competitive as all of the other car manufacturers start to come up to speed. But it more than anything, it was really around the governance and concerns around the governance around the company. And when Tesla was shooting the lights out financially, we got a lot of questions from clients. But for us, we just had to keep coming back to that point around stewardship, and we need to get really comfortable around the stewards of these businesses, and can we trust them with our clients' capital? Are they going to use it in the right ways? And so that posed some difficult questions for us at those times. Were we not exposed to electric vehicles? Well, of course we were exposed to electric vehicles, but we were doing it in different ways. And so we often find that where you have industries like that, where you've got one company that's kind of a darling of the sustainability market, like, it's further down the supply chain that a lot of these industries are going to get built up and become sustainable. And so in terms of electric vehicles, we have companies like Alfen in Europe who do charging stations, and they're universal charging stations, so whatever type of brand of vehicle that you have can charge those. We've got companies like Nordson in the US who do adhesives and liquid dispensing technologies, highly efficient, highly precise in the way they do it. And most of the top 10 battery manufacturers in the world are using their technologies to help stick their batteries together. They're helping to make sure that solar panels are more efficient through the way that they're stuck together. And so to us, they play really critical roles in actually enabling those solutions to happen. And we can get exposure to those areas that are going to grow a lot, that need to grow a lot, and if we're going to deliver a more sustainable economy, but not necessarily have to compromise on those stewardship and governance and other aspects. And it's more of a steady long-term approach, but it's one that we feel makes the most sense for us and for our investors.
I think your example is shows why it's so important to be aligned with the investors in your fund, because I can imagine when a certain stock is certain meme stocks that have really taken off, when they're shooting the lights out, as you said, there's a tendency to say, well, maybe we just look the other way on some of the governance issues, and we try and we ride this wave as well. And I think if you are setting your stall out from the start that you have these principles, then you can't really compromise them. And then over time, that commitment should be what investors are focused on, new investors that are interested in aligning with sustainable investment options. And so in just from a disclosures perspective, obviously that's where a lot of the effort is going. What's your thoughts on that? Is like the feeling I have is that regulators feel that if we have more disclosures, then that's going to lead to more informed decision making, and capital is going to flow in a certain direction, and it's going to create this cycle where capital flows into the right investments and it improves the sustainability of our planet, etc. But there's big assumptions there, obviously, that people can ascertain what they need to ascertain from those disclosures. Do you think it's going to have any impact?
So there's an amount of transparency and disclosure that's obviously required so you can understand a company, so you can understand an investor that you're investing with. And for us, so because we struggle with the ESG scores and ratings, even though like we rate quite well in terms of a lot of those ESG scores and ratings, but we can't stand behind those and put our hand out of heart and say that, yes, we think that they're a good way to understand us, regardless of whether we do well on them or not. And so the approach we took was to disclose all of the companies that we invest in on an interactive tool on our website, where we try to explain the investment case, why we think they're well positioned for sustainable development. We map them to the SDGs, but also to project drawdown and human development indicators. But we also talk about the risks, like what are the risks with this company and what are the engagement priorities? Where are the areas that we want to be able to have a long-term discussion with them to try and give that balanced view? We have invested in Nestle in the past, and one of my colleagues wrote an article about what they call the imperfect giant, because there are areas where Nestle is really essential to nutrition and helping to support nutrition, but then other areas where they're clearly on the wrong side of that story, but also other areas like plastic pollution and whatnot where they need to make quite significant changes. And so we try to be transparent in that way and sort of really trying to articulate our thinking. I feel like I think we have, as an industry, have spent decades demanding more disclosure and more disclosure, and yet not changing our actions and not changing the way that we do things and not actually having a meaningful impact on the way the world is operating. And so you have to question at some point, is more disclosure an answer to anything? And so I was having a discussion with someone the other day about the physical impacts of climate change. Now, clearly, if you're on the coast and the sea levels are rising and storm surge, that's an impact to that asset. It's a risk to that asset. But the questions are so much more complicated than that. So say you have a factory and you can get these days fairly fine grain forecasts, different scenarios of how different areas are going to be impacted. And your factory might be at the top of the hill, so it's less exposed to flood risk. But if the train tracks that you ship your products out on is at the bottom of the hill and is exposed to flood risk, there's still an enormous impact to your business that comes from that. And so, and if you're a diversified company and you have factories all over the world, that's a really gnarly and difficult issue to deal with. And the thing that we try to do is to understand the quality of the management team. Are they getting across these issues? Are they looking at how do they build resilience in their business, in their asset base? How do they deal with their suppliers and the infrastructure that they need in order to get their goods to market? And what is their financial quality? Do they have the capacity to invest, to change things, to ensure that they're resilient in the future as the climate does continue to change? And so the question then isn't so much about really detailed analysis and disclosure on the physical impacts that they're exposed to, although at one level, some of that's handy. But it really comes back more to the, what does it tell us about the quality of management? What does it tell us about the quality of the business? How well are they positioned and aligned to actually make the changes that are needed for the future? And how does that relate to their stakeholders as well, who are all important in helping a company be successful? And so I feel as though we sometimes go way too fine grain on disclosure and we demand more and more of it without actually using it as a way to understand what it says about the true quality of business, the true quality of management of business and the way that they conduct themselves.
Yeah, and I think the challenge from a disclosures perspective is for investment managers to figure out how they can disclose the right information to the likes of the investment advisors and other capital allocators and the average individual who's looking at a fund, where they want to put their money for retirement, because that's where we need the disclosures to actually make sense to the average individual. It's all well and good disclosing, you know, 80 pages of documents of information on something, but it's time constrained individuals that are looking to understand the key details. So I think that's where we need to probably see a lot of improvement. And I think that's where the regulators are going to be focused on the investment funds. You've seen it already. They're kind of clamping down on some of the claims that investment funds are making. So we'll likely see, I don't know what you think, but we'll probably start to see some sort of standardization in terms of the kind of claims that investment funds can make, how they're, and clearly be able to back up how they're incorporating sustainability into their investment process, ESG, etc., but in a way that the average individual can understand. Because obviously the more information you provide, it's easy to create the image that you're, you know, using this doing good or whatever these taglines they want to use.
Yeah, it's an interesting challenge for the regulators, because we wonder, does the way that the EU taxonomy, for instance, and trying to align with the taxonomy, I mean, we would use that as another useful framework that tells us a little bit of another expert view that we can say, is a company well positioned? Have they got headwinds or tailwinds? But is revenue the only way that you can understand whether a company's got headwinds or tailwinds in relation to those issues? I mean, we would argue not. And yet that's what is going to be the crux of the disclosure. And similarly with the sustainable financial disclosure requirements in the EU and Article 8 and Article 9 funds. So for all the wonks that are in there and in this space, we'll understand those terms. Some of the disclosures that sit underneath that share some of those challenges where they're not really going to tell the full story. And so I think what we try to do, and we're still trying to get better, we think that our disclosure has a lot of improvement that can happen with it. But we try to draw a line that goes from our investment beliefs and philosophy, the way that we invest, to the way that we think about sustainability, and then to the outcomes in terms of the companies that we're investing in and the work and what they're doing in the world. And we hope that those things align, and we hope that clients will challenge us on particular companies that we're investing in and say, well, you know, how does that company make sense? So the Nestle example is a good one, where we had client discussions and they were really helpful for us to continually challenge our own views on these types of issues. But I think if we drift towards, or if regulators drift towards an area where they go, well, this metric or this handful of metrics, they're going to tell you whether a fund is sustainable, I think we're going to find that it just becomes gamified. There was a lecturer doing a thing on artificial intelligence the other day at this event that I was at, and he was actually rubbishing the idea of transparency in relation to, he was talking about Elon Musk's desire to expose the algorithms for Twitter. It was kind of a flippant comment, but a really interesting one about what does transparency give us, is he says, Facebook releases a transparency report each year, but I still don't trust them. So is the transparency report the issue here, or is it about the way that that company conducts itself and acts that you can tell from a whole bunch of different things outside the transparency report, which is obviously only going to give you one story? So I think that they're the types of challenges with trying to focus on a very small set of metrics or a single ESG score or taxonomy alignment by revenue. Those are the dangers with just focusing on those kind of very limited areas.
Yeah, and one of the things in Europe is that we've got a lot of plans, but our implementation of these plans is where we're actually finding it difficult, I think. And the European Court of Auditors have come out recently, and the report I read said that we're still not doing enough to actually implement these plans. We're behind where we need to be, but also the glaring reality that unsustainable business activity is still too profitable. So we have conundrums, I suppose, that need to be addressed at an economic level before we can hope that investing in certain funds is going to change the world. And I think everyone can play a part, but I think as long as there is transparency on that reality and some of those challenges in terms of reaching a sustainable economic development to reach that point, that's what we need. And I think that sometimes there's too much talk about being sustainable rather than actually following through on those plans that are set. And that's not just at an investment level, but at a high policy level as well. From just to get the Australian perspective, what, you know, I suppose maybe it's unfair to say, but Australia is not known for its efforts on climate change, or maybe I'm being a bit harsh, but how are things locally from a responsible investment perspective? Is it something that has gathered momentum as it has in Europe? Is there more and more investors asking deeper questions about the impact of their investments?
Yeah, it's interesting from it. So I think it's completely fair that Australia has not done its bit on climate as a nation, and we deservedly wind up at the bottom a lot of those ratings, and particularly as a wealthy country that has amazing capacity to shift to renewables to help support our neighbours in their shift to renewables as well. We haven't done enough. But interestingly, from an investment perspective, there's been leadership from the beginning from investors in Australia. So the PR, the Principles for Responsible Investment, was started by an Australian, for instance. We have an investment community here that's been very active for a very long time. But there are those other issues, market issues, as I mentioned, and challenges that have permeated here. Interestingly, like the real drive has come in more recent times. So it's not going back to the 2006 when the PRI was started, but in the last few years where actual retail investors have seemed to have awoken to the huge savings pool in the superannuation system and wanting to demand that those that capital is being invested sustainably. And so the Responsible Investment Association of Australasia benchmarks the industry here, but also does consumer research every couple of years. 4 in 5 people expect that their super funds and that their banks are acting in an ethical way and investing responsibly. So it's not that they want a sustainable product, like a labeled product. They expect that they're doing it anyway in their default options, in their mainstream options. This is the standard expectation. 74% say that they would move providers if they found that they were really uncomfortable with some of the investments that were being made or the way that they were being invested. And this is where that transparency can have a really important impact in terms of helping people understand, well, does the way that these funds are investing match with how I perceive sustainable investment should be? And that idea, so, you know, you get a lot of surveys that say, oh, people will move their money, and then do they really? But you actually are seeing it. So according to Morningstar, 41% growth in sustainable funds first quarter this year versus last year, and it's more than doubled in the last 2 years. And so you are seeing an increasing number of people in Australia who are putting their money where their mouth is and shifting their money into more sustainable investments. And so I think under the surface is a bit of a different story to what you might see from the top-down view and just sort of seeing what's Australia's historical position been on climate. And I think for our region, like Asia and the Asia Pacific, is such an important area for climate. So we have, obviously, with 2 countries in China and India, you have more than 3 billion people living there. They are at the front lines, as are Asia Pacific neighbours, who are already suffering from rising sea levels. And I think Australia, as a country with lots of intellectual capacity, with lots of financial capital, with great resources in terms of wind, in terms of sun, tidal. I mean, we have the full buffet of potential solutions here, iron ore for green steel. I mean, there's huge opportunities for Australia to play a very important role in resolving some of the big challenges that we face in the region. And even on the food side, we export 2/3 of the food that we farm in this country, but we need to farm it more sustainably because we're also subject to the changing impacts of climate change. We've seen record floods earlier this year, which followed a decade of record droughts. And so Australia has some challenges, but we've also got a huge opportunity to be a part of the solution for our region in particular.
Yeah, I think there's 2 important points there. The fact that you're seeing real demand in terms of investors moving into sustainable investments, and also the fact that even though Australia is known for some of the negative media coverage around its action on climate change, there's real opportunity there. And I think a country like Australia and others, there's an opportunity to be a beacon for other countries to follow. And if we do see more action on the ground, then that's where we'll see the real impact, because other politicians will take note of that. And in the end of the day, politicians will be driven by voters as well. And as voters become more informed and see things happening in countries like Australia, they'll want to see it happening in their own countries. I know there was a great documentary I watched recently on Australia, and a climate activist went down to the coal mines, and you know, it was kind of going into the depths of hell for a climate activist, because he really wasn't wanted there. But he started having really open discussions with these people, and what became clear was that they're open to change, but they also need a livelihood. And I think that's where we need to get to. We need to recognize that it isn't like a light switch that we can turn on and we can just become sustainable. We have to recognize the complexities behind all of this, including countries in Australia. You've had communities built around these sectors. They need to live as well, so you can't just turn them off, but you have to find alternative employment, alternative options for the communities. And that if we can recognize that, then we've more of a chance of reaching that point of transition to sustainable economic development. I think those points get missed. I think a lot of times it's like, oh, people are just clinging to these old industries. Well, they're clinging to them because they're also clinging to their livelihood. So recognizing those challenges is going to be an important point.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's not a matter of promising something down the track. People want to see things changing, and you need a lot of investment to flow into those regions. And we have seen the beginnings of that. And I think we will see a lot more of it as more and more companies and hopefully with government support that they become an area of investment. So how do you transition something like Newcastle Port, which primarily transports coal out of the country, into doing something else? How do you transition Gladstone, which is liquefied natural gas, into something like hydrogen? Is that a viable solution for the future? And you are seeing some of the business leaders really step up to that. And on the community side, we just had an election last weekend, and it was quite an extraordinary result because both the major parties didn't do as well as they had done historically, and these independent candidates and the Green Party's got a big uplift in votes. And I think that there is a real mood for, it's constantly worried me over the years, and particularly you look at say, politics in the US and in other places, the filter bubbles and the polarization, and it's just so toxic, the political debate in so many of these areas. But this most recent election in Australia was a really hopeful one, I felt, because it's not about what side of politics you're on. The Australian community, I think, by and large, voted for an end to the way that type of politics is done, and for people who had a clear mandate around climate and a clear mandate around corruption and integrity in politics, and lastly, a clear mandate around the treatment of women and equality for women, because we're a long way to go in that area as well here in Australia. And so unlike so many elections in the past, I actually filled some hope after last weekend.
Well, Pablo, it was great chatting to you. I have to say, we keep chatting on this subject because it is a very, very broad topic. I think the key points from our discussion that I take anyway are the fact that there's a complexity to this. There is a variety of approaches. And most of all, we need more authentic communication in terms of informing investors who want to invest in sustainable investment options. And it's also, I must say, great to get the Australian perspective. I was in Oz almost 4 months I spent in Sydney. So I've fond memories from Australia as a beginner surfer down in Manly Bay. But no, it was great chatting to you, and I appreciate you coming on the podcast.
True, Vincent. Thank you. Really nice to talk to you.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the ESG Factor podcast. If you'd like to share any thoughts or feedback on today's episode, then you can email me at vincent@theesgfactor.com. Also, if you'd like to see the making of more independent content like this, you can join our Patreon community online. Just visit theesgfactor.com.